privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. She is home right by Celia. She has a year sober. She is of service, actually in one of the meetings that I secretary. She's a very good friend of mine. Help me welcome Marianne.
On a mission trip. So traveling back into the States, working in a beauty shop, started school, I began to really struggle because at that point I was trying to build an adult life. I was trying to go to school, I was trying to work, I was trying to pay bills, I was supporting myself, and I started having a lot of difficulty operating in the adult world because of my inability to be present. And I found myself in situations where I was trying to buy something and I couldn't see, and somebody would trigger me, remind me of my perpetrator, and I would behave in really bizarre ways. And I realized that I was in trouble if I wanted to have anything like a decent life, because it was something that I couldn't control. So, along with realizing that I needed some pretty, you know, intense psychotherapy so I wouldn't be insane the rest of my life, I also began to drink wine regularly with a couple of the women that I worked with, and I really enjoyed that. Within about 3 years of having found a very good therapist and continuing to drink through this time, but not in a way that was messy enough to get my attention or anybody else's attention, but it nagged me inside all the time, and I always avoided discussing it with anybody, honestly. So, had some therapy. At that point, I met my husband, and in the last, you know, the previous 3 years, I had unlearned the dissociation and had begun to drink. So, I thought, after sorting out a lot of my crap with my family's background and my abuse and uncovering a lot of the history of my family with sexual abuse, that I've got this. I'm good. I am above any other major problems, and if anybody needs help on sorting out their problems, I got it. So, I met my husband, and he was intelligent, and I could tell that he was going to be successful, and I thought, this is great. I'm going to marry somebody that's, you know, going to get a lot of education, will have money, which I did not have growing up, and my life is going to finally be good. And along with that, I'm a Catholic convert, so in my Catholic faith, I started living according to some of the more orthodox traditions of the Catholic faith. And on top of thinking that I've got all my shit together because I've worked on it and, you know, I'm becoming better than my parents, I also thought, hey, I'm doing things God's way, so my life's going to go well. It will be what it is in my fantasy. So, I got married, and during our, you know, dating and early marriage, I drank more and more, but if I had to categorize my kind of drinking during that time, I would say I was a binge drinker. And primarily because I didn't have the money to support more of a habit. But once I started drinking, even then, I would drink as much as I could, and I didn't care. I would drain my town, whatever. But I remember going to parties with my husband and him holding back my hair. Everybody's so sweet. It's so nice to do this to me. So, pausing before I go into the next big chunk of life not going my way. My husband is the child of two very progressive alcoholics. And we have both learned in the last year, I have only a little bit more than a year, that children of alcoholics are not necessarily going to be alcoholics, but they have an 80% chance of marrying an alcoholic. I was not obviously in my disease at the time that we met or at the time that we married. But we found each other and our broken pieces fit perfectly. So, match made in hell. Who's been married? Come on, right? It's all are the rose. So I'm happy to say that we're still married. Thanks to God. So, within about 6 months of getting married, I conceived our first child and was so thrilled because we were beginning our big, perfect, beautiful, clean, sterile, quiet, obedient Catholic family. And I just knew that, I just knew that it was going to be perfect. I had a lot of presumption at the time, presumption on God, arrogance myself, my self-will, that, you know, I'd done everything right, so it was going to be okay. I had an excellent pregnancy, and 1 week to the day after my due date, I experienced severe pain. Went to the hospital thinking, you know, yeah, this is supposed to hurt. I'm in labor. And they sent me home saying, no, you're not. I was presented with seizures. And they said, no, you're not really in labor. Come back. So when my labor did fully start, I went back. And at about 11 o'clock at night, I coded. And I had an aneurysm that we didn't know about in my splenic artery, which is the third largest artery in the body. And so I bled to death very quickly. My son was born with C-section, of course, within, because of the chaos, it's anywhere between like 21 and 39 minutes. Nobody's really sure. He was born almost dead. And after the full-scale resuscitation of him and myself, I'll pause, when they opened up my abdomen, it was full of blood. And the fact that I was in labor at the hospital with a reason to have my abdominal cavity opened up surgically is what saved my life. So they were able to give me blood, and CAT scans later on showed that there didn't seem to be any brain damage. Now, my husband will tell you otherwise, but I think I'm okay. So, back to the moment of Andrew's birth. Full resuscitation. He clearly had neurological problems from the beginning. We brought him home after being at, in the NICU of children with an NG tube. And I began a full-scale mission of self-will. I was going to fix this baby and make him okay. So within 4 months, we moved to Indiana, where we didn't know anybody from my husband to do in graduate school. And at 7 months, Andrew was diagnosed with cerebral palsy and was almost dead from starvation, and that began a hellish nightmare that gave me a fantastic excuse to be drunk a lot. And my son is 9 years old now, and we have 3 younger children as well, and he has severe cerebral palsy, and he's cognitively very aware that he's incontinent, and we feed him with the G-tube, and he cannot do anything for himself. So, the darkness that opened up was already there inside of me, but it exploded my sense of entitlement for what I was owed, what I thought God would give to me because of the choices that I had made. It absolutely opened up the worst selfishness inside of me, that I did not want this. This was not attractive. This was not fun. This was not feel good. I wanted to nurse and be an attachment parenting mom with cute little flings and, you know, have all these stair-step children afterwards, and, you know, I had to figure that out. I just wasn't that. So my drinking definitely began to escalate at that point. We bought our first home, had Michael. After Michael was born, I remember thinking for the first time, I was had maybe half a bottle of Shiraz. Wow, I wish I could feel this way all the time. I felt relief from the stressful fear and anxiety that I experienced over Andrew all the time. I felt rest because Andrew didn't sleep, and so I was exhausted in ways that I never knew that it was possible to be exhausted. And I was still convinced when I drank, then my fantasies returned, and I knew that it was going to be okay. And I knew that we can continue having children and have a big, beautiful family, and I'm just going to walk, and it's going to be all right. Everything's going to be okay when I drink. And that felt nice. And by the time Andrew was 4.5 or 5, we started having nurses in the home quite a bit. And I hated that. Our home in Indiana was small. Its nose, 6 months out of the year, was second size. And I was uncomfortable with myself. And there was nowhere to go. And so drinking became an everyday event at that point. I did have a really nice time stripping our garage, a detached garage in Indiana, of all the old layers of paint. I did that with Manhattan. And that was a really fun summer. And the cheap stuff was fine with me. We were on a graduate school budget. And that old crow, or whatever that stuff is called, just, you know, every black of you, it's just okay to think. So, anyway. So, that was after Michael was born. Then the nurses were in the house. I started drinking on a regular basis. It was absolutely a priority on my grocery shopping list. And my fear of Andrew, my inability to control his cerebral palsy, my rage and anger at God, life, at my son, was absolutely overwhelming. So drinking was my solution because I'm an alcoholic, and alcohol was my solution to those issues. I can see my third child, my third son, and struggled during that pregnancy for the first time not to drink. And I choked. I did everything right with Andrew, and this is what happened. So, you know, who cares? It's going to be fine. But I really struggled. The truth was that I was struggling to only have, you know, a few glasses of wine a week. And I would smell my husband's whiskey and take little sips, and it was hard. So, Andrew was born. He's fine. And the nurses, the kids, it basically becomes a boring story, so I just kept drinking at that point. Adeline, my youngest, and please God, my last, was born while we were still in Indiana, and again struggled through that entire pregnancy. And after Daniel's birth, I started ignoring Andrew. And the more that I drank, the easier it was to just shut him out of my life and not look at him, not love him, because it hurt and I didn't know how, because I'm selfish and I want what I want if he wasn't what I wanted. So 2 years ago, my husband got a position back in the valley where we were both born and raised. And I'm very grateful for that. It would have been very hard, I think, much harder at least, to become sober in Indiana, because all of our friends drank, and that's just, we did. So we moved back to Visalia, and at that point, my nurses were gone, which I loved having nobody in my house. But then, who's going to take care of him? Who's going to take care of him? And how am I going to do this all? There's nobody here to help. And that was the point where I started drinking in the morning. And Michael started kindergarten. And I remember going to pick him up and being self-conscious that my breath was down. And I didn't want people to get the wrong impression and think I had a problem, because of course I didn't. And just above it just because I was. So, at that point, I also, well, because we were in the valley and it's just freaking hot here, discovered gin and tonics and started going through about a bottle of wine and, you know, several gin and tonics and a lot of whiskey a day. And I would hide the beer in the refrigerator and kind of try to mask the sound of it opening in the morning. Yeah, I'm super gross. So, around that time, I also got very sick with pneumonia and started, well, I didn't start. I was, they prescribed Vicodin, and I was very enamored of how nice that felt, and wow, no wonder people like use this shit all the time. And that actually did scare me. I didn't go down that road. Again, I'm not sure why, just probably, honestly, because I didn't have the opportunity. If I had the opportunity, then I'd have to. So that was October. Fast forward to May, and this is about a year and a half from ago now. My sister made some decisions that really broke my heart. And I saw how she was delusional. Not because she was a drunk like me, but because of all of her other faults that I didn't have. And she was delusional and was thinking that she could do all some big, some really destructive decisions that would not hurt her family. And I began to figure it out at that point that I didn't want to do destructive things and think that it wasn't affecting my family. Around this time, I also had a dream that I was standing in a forest, drunk, which makes sense. I mean, I've had an awful time at this point. So I was drunk in my dream, probably because I was really drunk in my sleep. And I was saying to the ranger, who did not want me to be chopping down trees, which is what we were doing, I'm sure she was really thinking about it, because I was drunk. So we're chopping down trees, and I was kind of, and I said, we may drink and cut down trees, but we don't get divorced. And, you know, there's my stamp of superiority there. So I woke up from that dream. Shaken. And my dear friend who I went to drink with at the beauty shop now has almost 6 years of sobriety, and I wanted to call her very badly and say, I'm ready to go to AA. But I wasn't quite ready to give up the control of my secret. Around this time, it's very difficult to, like, put all of these events in order because it happened very fast, and it was clearly, like, God was setting me up to either, I don't know, die or get sober. So, I also went to see, no, my son, one of my kids was paid to a monkey, and I thought, I know what I'm going to do while I was here at the pool. I'm going to memorize the entire Serenity Prayer. Again, this was in response to my sister making these terrible decisions because she was delusional. So, I memorized the entire Serenity Prayer, having no idea that that was the prayer at all. I also went within a couple of weeks of this time to see my therapist who helped me so much in my recovery. And as I was getting ready to leave, I said, well, I think I'd like to come back. And she said, why? You're doing great. You're doing fine. And I said, well, and she said, well, what is it? I drink. Now, she's a recovered alcoholic as well, with 30-some years of sobriety. And she said, oh, how much do you drink? I said, a lot. What's your husband saying? I said, he thinks I'm an alcoholic. Which wasn't true. Because my husband thought, when he looked at alcoholism, he saw normal. So even though it was in front of him, he didn't know what it was. But I said that anyway and told him the next week. Actually, Robbie Cooper said that, but that was my moment of admitting something to myself. And she said, well, I think you're an alcoholic too. And I said, I do too. And it was really horrifying. Because up until that point, I had not talked about my drinking out loud to a soul. And admitting it to somebody, to anybody, meant that I didn't have the control of the secret anymore. And that was hard to give up that control. And there's no taking it back. I mean, once it's said, once it's out there in the universe, it's done. So anyways, shortly after that, I found myself at my first AA meeting. My first AA meeting was on 24th at the John Coleman Bridge Street meeting. And I wasn't done drinking yet, but it was only within a couple of weeks of starting to go to that meeting that I did achieve a sobriety date of July 13th. So the entire Trinity prayer goes like this. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as a pathway to peace. Taking the simple world as Jesus did, taking the simple world as it is, not as I would have it. Trusting that if I will surrender to his will, he will make all things right. That I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever in the next. Now, when I told my therapist that I had memorized the entire Trinity prayer, she belly laughed for like a minute. And said, honey, the joke is really on you. You didn't know what you were doing. Continue to struggle with my higher power. songs really were about me trying to control everything and be God. And I didn't. I never felt like that before. And that, we were talking about this at the meeting last night, is one of the, I think, biggest chunks of my sobriety and recovery that is ahead of me is building a relationship with my higher power. And you know, there's a lot of stuff that I still am working on. I haven't finished my steps. My sponsor's sitting right there, so I can't pretend otherwise. I haven't finished my steps. I have a lot of things to face still. I have my amends to do. And that's okay, because this is a one day at a time life that goes on until the day that I die. And my hope is that I'll stay on this road for the rest of my life, continue to grow, continue to heal, just one day at a time. And the amount of growth and healing and joy that I've been able to experience, because when I thought about not drinking, I thought that that's just, I couldn't imagine life without alcohol. That wouldn't be worth living. And I really thought that, like, a life without alcohol, just what would be the point? And that wasn't trauma. That was really how I felt. And I was definitely afraid of not having that and still being alive. But I haven't had a drink in, you know, I think, I don't know, 13 or 14 months, and I am still alive. And I'm capable of joy that I was never capable of when I was drinking. So, I'm out of time. And with that, what I say in most meetings is, that's what I've got, and I'm going to keep coming back. And that's my plan. Thank you.